This is the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Fur Neiman. If you're looking to generate wealth and passive income in the lucrative world of mobile home parks, you're in the right place. You'll discover solutions to the common legal and operational pitfalls and how to optimize parks to maximize income. Your host is in the trenches. He's a real estate attorney, financial analyst, and mobile home park investor and operator. Now, let's turn it over to Fur Neiman.
Welcome back, Mobile Home Park Nation. Fur Neiman here again today with another episode of the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast. Got another great guest for you today. Interested to hear his stories, his tips, his tricks for all of us. Please help me welcome my guest, Walter Johnson. Walter, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm glad
you got it. Well, we were talking offline about some of the challenges in the space and active management and all that. We'll get into some of that, but maybe tell the rest of us a little bit more of your background, how you got into the mobile home park space.
Yeah, so I was buying single family homes and apartment buildings and land and condos as investment properties. And I thought that was actually the cool thing to do, right? You make a couple hundred bucks, $500-$600 on a property, but you scale it because you're buying so many of them. But when they're vacant or somebody doesn't pay, you have to actually pay, for the roof. I mean, it gets expensive. It just knocks out your cash flow. So I started learning about mobile home parks probably in 2012-ish and studied it for about 3 years, co-called a lot of them, got a lot of information. I remember I was looking, I looked at it, but I bought it as well. I double escrowed it. And he said, it was actually the last one. And he says, when I had all of them, I was making about $150,000 a month, and that actually piqued my interest. Yes, I wasn't making that single family homes. And so I started really, really diving into it and bought my first one in 2017-18. So I was a mortgage broker for I think probably 15 years or so. And a friend of mine, a good mentor, just said, "Hey, Walter, you're actually chasing commissions. You're not chasing wealth." And that actually, changed my attitude as far as a career and investing. So that's kind of how I got started in parks.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff. I mean, yeah, part of the goal of real estate investing for a lot of us, in particular, you can get to the level of passive is, the horizontal income, the income you make when you sleep. And then you stop working for time or you stop working for a commission, you start working for more wealth and have, build a system, build a process, build a team. I like to say it's not a pyramid scheme. It's, it's just a team of people that can, everybody can, high tide lift all, rise all boats kind of thing. But, that's good to see you make that jump in your career. So tell me, what kind of deals do you look for and how do you find them?
I find them off. When I say off market, I don't want to say I buy off market to where they're actually retail. They just haven't been listed to the public yet. What I'm talking about, I buy them strictly from mom and pops. And the reason why I can do that, the reason why I want to do that is because they're better cap rates, one. And two is that I spend my own money marketing. And yes, marketing is actually expensive. I think right now we're approaching like $3-$4 a piece is because we have copywriters and how we actually design it. We want to get a higher open rate. So we went from, let's say, 2% open rate or 1.75 to about 12%. And so that extra, let's say 10% helps us get more, open rate and more conversations with sellers.
Now this open rate, is that your track? You obviously have data to track it. Is this via like eBlast or are these, postcards or mailers?
Mailers. Yeah. So we write them. We don't write them ourselves, but we actually hire copywriters and actually we probably do about 4 a year, but they can range anywhere from between 8,000 and 12,000 pieces.
Now, how are you tracking the open rate on those?
So how we track the open rate, we actually track the calls. So if we look at, let's say, if we did a 12,000 mailer, we got about 120 calls. And on those 120 calls, we got every 30 calls is actually a deal. So that's usually how it works. And that's actually the 1%. But when we actually increase that to 12%, of course, then we get a higher callback.
So how are you getting a higher callback? Just better content or better packages?
Better content, better envelopes. Yeah.
Yeah. I get a lot of envelopes in my mail. And I remember there's one guy in particular, And he changes them, which I thought was kind of cool. Like Valentine's Day, I'll get like a Valentine envelope. St. Patrick's Day, I'll get a St. Patrick's Day. When I'm like, you guys are spending some serious money on.
Probably got it from me, right? Is that how you found me?
No, I didn't get it. I don't think it's from you. And I'm like, these are some expensive envelopes. And what's crazy, I know who it is because he's actually a client of mine. He sold his parks now, so now he's not a client anymore. But I know his company name on the label, and I'm just like, he's spending all this money sending to me. He doesn't know it's me, apparently. I'm like, and I always thought it was, so I wasn't going to sell to him. And I knew it was him because his company name, but I always opened him anyway, just because I was like, I want to see the next level. He'd send me like, you know, what are you doing for New Year's Eve? And it'd have like a bow tie shaped envelope. And like, you got to be spending some serious dough sending all these out. And sometimes I'll get three or four of them because I've got different LLCs coming to the same mailbox. So I'm like, oh, this LLC owns this park. I'm like, I should just call him and tell him to take me off his list and save him $50.
Right. All right. So there's a key to do that. You actually just remove the duplicate. So if you see your name, but you own the LLC, so to speak, or you see the same LLC, you just remove those duplicates.
Yeah. Or you think the same mailing address, you know, I mean,
you can do that. Yeah, absolutely. So there's ways to actually decrease that, but yeah, it works. Absolutely.
One time I had a client that asked me to write a letter like that for him. And it was, I mean, I'm not a copywriter, but I'm, you know, fairly well written. And I just wrote him a pretty basic letter. And I got one in the mail because I was on his call list. So I was like, he literally paid me to write a letter that he then paid to mail to me to see if I wanted to sell him one of my parks.
That is amazing.
Yeah. So it was the only time that ever happened. But okay, yeah. So that's one of the tricks for just better envelopes, you know, better system tracking the calls. Okay, so is that the main way you find deals? Is letters, or you any relations with brokers, or pretty much just straight off market direct to seller?
Direct to sellers, yes. We actually call too. So I call. I spent a lot of money creating call center software actually. So it's like a predictor dialer, and it just calls, and that actually helps as well.
How do you source your lists?
I pay for it. So I pay for it commercial. Let's say you can actually go through, let's say CoStar. So CoStar is, you know, I would say the directory of MLS, you know, for commercial properties, right? But it's expensive. I don't think we pay like 12, 14 grand a year or something like that.
Yeah, CoStar. I don't have any more. I used to have it. Yeah, it's definitely a powerful tool, but not the least expensive software out there. Lots of softwares and tools and so on. And I've bought lists before, and I've built my own list, and then I bought lists that were worthless. And then, you know, I'm on a bunch of broker lists, but a lot of those deals are super competitive. So they tend to be tough to make pencil a lot of times as well, but, you know, try to tackle all avenues you can.
Yeah, but you know, if you spend $50,000, $60,000 a year, but you bought a park and you bought it $1 million below the value, it pays off.
Yeah, no, for sure. Okay. Well, that's some good information, good tips. Appreciate it. Maybe tell me what do you think is a good operational strategy or operational tip you want to share with the audience? Something you've learned maybe over the years?
Yes, I would say for operations, I would say have a great manager, and I have a part-time manager as well that actually helps, and a maintenance person. I think that really helps, actually. I would say that, yes.
Now, what's your opinion on how many sites you need for a particular manager? Like if you have a 30-site park, how many hours you got for a manager, or do you think you need 70 sites to have a full-time manager, or do you have 5 30 site parks and have more of an area manager?
I would say the latter, but at 30 spaces, well, we don't deal with 30 spaces, but if we did, one would actually work as well. But if it was 80 spaces, yes, I would actually have a manager part-time and a maintenance person.
I've kind of gone back and forth depending on the park and depending on the market, but a lot of times, like if I can only afford a maintenance or a manager, I kind of prefer the maintenance and then do some of the management remote and ghost showings and things like that. But then, you know, having a maintenance guy out front, it also has its own challenges. I just know for us, it's been a challenge where you can't afford a full-time maintenance guy or even a half-time maintenance guy. And then it's like, crap, now I got a clogged toilet and I have to call a plumber, and they're like, we're 4 days out.
Right.
If I just had a maintenance guy, it's $22. Go down the hall, you know, take care of it. Do you have one preference over the other, or do you insist on having both and just finding parks that can absorb both?
Yeah, exactly. Just have both and have a park that actually can absorb and pay the cost for both. When you actually have a problem, let's say, and, you know, let's just talk about like a private utilities, and you actually have an issue, you want to tackle that as fast as possible. And so the managers usually is more specialized in actually filling up vacant lots and collecting rent. The maintenance person can get on it as well. And the maintenance person probably knows a buddy of his that can actually, he can call and be like, hey, buddy, I actually need your help right now. And you can pay him $10.99 as well.
Yep. Now you mentioned private utilities. Which private utilities have you tackled? And you know, any, you know, change your mind? You know, like, for example, I'm under contract on deal with a lagoon. And I just talked to an investor today because I thought you didn't like lagoons. I said, I don't like lagoons, but I'm willing to buy this one because I like the deal. And despite the lagoon, I just need to, you know, do a little bit more diligence, do a little bit more, you know, digging on, and then obviously got to pad my expenses. I got an operating expense that I otherwise wouldn't have. I got to increase my cap rate on the refi or the exit than I otherwise would. So it's a risk, but I'm trying to mitigate it. I'm willing to tackle lagoon. It's just not ideal, but you make it work. What about you? What private utilities are you willing to do?
Not all of them, not like water, sewer, you know, treatment plants. I haven't done a lagoon yet. I've done wells. I've done private, you know, of course, sewers. I've done private electricity. I don't mind them. Of course, you have to do your due diligence. You can buy them at a higher cap rate. You can cash flow tremendously because there's not a lot of competition in that because everyone wants private utilities. And to me, in my experience, the expense went up 10, 12%. Now it sounds like a lot, but if you're buying it at a, you know, double, you know, high digit cap rate, then I think it actually makes sense.
So what, so 10, 12%. So what is that for one utility, for just a well, you got, it's adding 10% to your numbers.
Well, right? Yeah, the expenses. So let's say if you have to replace the pumps, or you have to do water testing for the sewer once a month, or not for the sewer, but the actual well, and something actually happens to the wells, and you have the maintenance person that has to be certified, and you actually have to pay him his labor to certify it every month. Maybe it's we have ADEQ, which is a, you know, government, you know, I say quality control department that actually checks it, and they come out. Right. So these things that you know, costs come into play when you're dealing with private utilities. Yes, it increases your expenses, but it doesn't bother me.
Yeah, I found on my parks, I found the well to be a lot more expensive than the lagoon. The lagoon has been, there's a monthly cost, but I guess the skill or the risk of the sewer is not as great as the skill necessary to handle the drinking water, which, you know, makes some sense. But the water guy's, you know, professional and expensive. We have parks where if we submeter, we have to get, I think it depends on the state, but a grade A license. But a grade A license is, you can get for $200 in a day's class. But the grade B license is like, you're an engineer in water quality safety, and you charge $1,000 a month to exist, you know, much bigger expense.
Right. Yeah. So you're talking about that cost. So it actually adds up. Or if the actual well, you know, it leaks somewhere, you actually have to trace that and figure out where it's at. So, you know, once you actually repair it and you monitor it, I think it's okay. But having that initial expense really kind of puts a dent on the expenses for a few months.
Got it. Okay. So what about, what's your preference on, you know, leasing homes versus selling homes, and what tips do you have for, you know, moving homes?
I'm going to be a hypocrite on this one, right? So I'm going to totally contradict myself. So I've owned, you know, park-owned homes. Some were actually great. Some were a nightmare. I just couldn't wait to get rid of them. Some I just gave away for free. Some I sold for $2,000 and $9,000 and $12,000 cash. Some I did, you know, payments, you kind of a rent to own or lease to own for 12 months just to get rid of it. But then we're actually looking at a park right now. So we're actually going to do public housing that they're going to pay about almost $2,900 each space. So,
wow.
Yeah. So
for a manufactured home.
Yeah. So
how, what market is that in?
Right here at home in Phoenix.
Okay, so, man, that's, yeah, a lot.
So I look at that.
You can pay for that house in a year and a half.
Right. And, if I pay for that, even with the expenses, so, you know, we're netting even at 30%, 40% expenses, but it's a brand new house, so our expenses won't be that much. But let's just say it's a 30, 40% expense ratio. We're doing extremely well. So,
you don't like parking homes, but you do if the government's going to pay you $2,900 a lick.
100%. Yes.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Right. So I think that one we're probably going to net after all expenses about $1 million a year.
Wow. How many units? They're doing quite a few units then.
It's only a 53.
But they're going to do all 53. Mm-hmm. And are they bringing the homes in, or are you bringing them in?
I'm bringing them in. Yeah.
You're bringing them in, then you're leasing them out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're bringing them in. I think we'll be each home with, the home is about 47,000, 3 bedrooms, 2 baths. And then we're at, I would say about 10 grand with setup and AC and all that stuff.
Got it.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. Okay. So prefer parking homes. What's the minimum deal size you guys like?
Well, that one's 53. So that's actually probably the lowest we'll go, but the numbers work. But usually we're at the 80 to 80 plus, I would say.
Okay. Got it. All right.
That actually makes sense when we can actually hire a maintenance and a manager.
Right. Now, what lessons can you share about selling homes or leasing homes? Any special tips? Are you guys selling on Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist? You know, do you hire a realtor? What's the plan to move homes typically?
Facebook Marketplace is actually great. Word of mouth is actually great. Banners in front of the actual park is actually great. Mailer. So go to Walmart and or Home Depot or something, and just put, you know, homes for sale and put the mobile home park, and you'll get some hits as well.
Sure.
Yes.
And you put those around town, or do you mean in the near the park with an arrow?
So the signs, those are actually in front of the park, but the actual mobile home parks flyers, we'll go to Walmart, we'll go to Home Depot, we'll go to a laundromat. We'll actually post in a local newspaper as well.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, absolutely. People still read the local newspaper.
Yeah, I've had less luck on that. I did that 5-6 years ago. You know, post them in the laundromats is a big deal. And we just never got a ton of leads off of them. We did it for whatever reason. And we'd go back until, you know, you take the little tear off things and you tear off the first one or two because nobody wants to be first, right? So you make it look like this is an active place to live. And we'd go back in a week and there'd be none of them torn off. We'd have no calls. We're like, you know, people used the laundromat. So like clearly they were there. But we just had never had a lot of luck with that. We've had a ton of luck with Facebook Marketplace. Craigslist has got a lot of, we've kind of turned away from because it's got a lot of scammers on there and stuff. So it's really been, you know, negative energy trying to, you know, move a home and deal with 100 people. Send me your wire instructions. I'm ready to move in. I'm ready to move in. It's like,
yeah, that Nigerian prince guy is he's still out there.
Right.
All right. One of the things we do is that we actually do flyers and post it on our residents. So, and we give a referral. So if they actually bring someone, we actually give a referral as well. So somebody actually to rent a home, like if we had an empty park owned home, or if somebody comes in, they buy a house.
What kind of referral fee you pay for those?
Which one?
For either rent or for sale.
For rent, it's so if we're renting one of our park owned homes and they actually refer someone, we give them $250.
Yeah. That's what we do too. We don't have we definitely get some of them. I don't think we get like one a week or anything like that, but we get several year that have referrals, and depends on the park. We get some parks where half people are related. Sometimes it's negative where it's like, oh no, you know, more of their family is a problem, but discriminate like, oh no, we can't have your family moving here, we only want the other guy's family.
Yeah can't do that. Or we do it near tax time, we do it near the holidays, like Christmas, things like that.
Yeah, tax time. Well, for you in Arizona it's a little warmer, so you probably get some movement around Christmas. For us, nobody wants to move around the holidays because it's cold and nasty.
Yeah, so no.
If you don't sell a home by Thanksgiving, it's hard to sell it before tax season.
Got it. Yes. I mean, we can have a Christmas and it's 75 degrees outside, sunny.
No. Yeah, a little different.
All right. You're wearing cargo shorts on opening Christmas presents. That's how it is.
So what's your favorite type of park to buy? Do you like to buy a deal that's stabilized? Do you like to buy a value add with like infrastructure issues that you can fix, or just low occupancy, or any of the above?
Yeah, low occupancy. I don't like to buy usually stabilized, because when you buy and stabilize, one, there's nothing to do and there's nothing to learn. Two is that, you know, the price is actually pretty close to retail. They know what they got.
Yeah.
Infrastructure, not necessarily. I mean, it's, you know, they're always going to have some problems. I would say some hair, but some have big hairs and some have, you know, small hairs. So we look at case by case. They got one right now that's low occupancy. I think it's like 40% or something like that we're looking at. Do I mind that? You filling it up over the next 3 years? No.
Yeah. No, I've one challenge I've had is low occupancy in smaller markets, just trying to get the occupancy up. You know, it's like I'll pay nothing for it, but then it's like, man, it's slow. It's slower versus low occupancy in a, you know, medium-sized market. Like, okay, this is easy peasy. You put a home in, you got 10 phone calls the first day, you pick one, you know, and move it along. But smaller markets, it's like, we'll have people that want the house, but it's a bigger numbers game. Cause it's like, oh great, I got 10 applications. And some of the people are like, I make 900 a month. Can you approve me for 750 a month? Or like, not even close. They're like, well, I got half the deposit. Like, what? You know, yeah. You know, one guy had 97% debt to income ratio. Wow. and was frustrated that we couldn't approve him. Like, but I got a job. Like, yeah, you also got a $900 truck payment. You shouldn't have got the truck, you know.
Right.
Cost three times as much as the house you just got rejected for.
Yeah, no, you'll get those stories. They're great stories, right? But yeah, those slower markets, I mean, they'll hit you. And I don't like those actually for rent either. Cause when you're renting, you have so many rentals. Now you're just in a landlord business and that your expenses are higher. And yes.
I'm sure. What states are you operating in currently?
13 states, I would say. Red states, I would say.
In what parts of the country?
Bible Belt, Arizona, Southwest, Florida. Florida's a great market. I heard it's hot. It's too far for me to actually go because there's so many deals in the middle.
Sure.
Texas, I heard, is great. But I stay close to like the Oklahomas and the Iowa and Kansas, Missouri. Yes.
Okay, we're in some of the same states. We're in Missouri and Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Illinois. So more Midwest. Yeah. But
even Collinsville, Illinois is actually great.
I'm familiar with Collinsville. We used to play them in sports a little bit in high school. I grew up in Illinois.
So, okay.
And I still own seven or eight parks in Illinois, so still active over there. But nothing in Collinsville. But yeah, it's a good part. It's a good area.
Yeah, closer to like 30 minutes away from St. Louis, like that type of area. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a couple. We're under contract on a park 45 minutes east of St. Louis, so pretty close to Collinsville, actually.
Yeah. So, that's what we look at. Absolutely.
Okay. Cool. What other topics you want to cover?
Washington actually might be a good. Washington State, the rent control actually didn't pass.
Oh, really? I haven't followed that one there. So, how close was it to passing? I mean, was it imminent, and then it just failed last minute?
Yep.
Wow. That's how Iowa was a couple years ago, and I'm glad it didn't go through, but. There's been more and more coming around. I feel like the right of first refusal for tenants is becoming more prevalent even than rent control. I'm seeing that on a lot of agendas, and you know, a lot of times the residents think they want to buy the park but really can't, so it's slowing up transaction volume. I had another park where a client of mine was under contract and the seller gave notice to the residents and they said okay. And they ended up buying it. My client was buyer, and part of the contract was if the residents buy it, buyer gets reimbursed all of its out-of-pocket costs. So that's what happened. So we had to do, wasn't even closing time. We had to do like a closing invoice, and we're like, what's going on? They're like, seller's going to pay you. We're done. Like, happened? He's like, yeah, it's happening. So it's definitely a growing phenomenon. So pros and cons of that, but.
Yeah, I don't think it'll catch on to where it'll create enough competition for all of us. I mean, there's too many parks. There's too many, you know, there's too many, I would say, cooks in the kitchen when it comes to that. So it does happen, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, I'm looking for what other trends are you seeing or other forecasts you got for the industry here? Right now it's April of 24. What do you foresee in the industry the rest of 24, 25 going forward?
Yeah, that's funny. Actually, I do a keynote speak in June for 2 days, one on manufactured housing, one on RV parks. I think RV parks are actually here to stay. I think more people actually want to buy RV parks and actually move in a mobile home park. That is true. I think that's actually a feasible idea. You know, lenders don't like them, but it's happening. I think mobile home parks are going to get more expensive for sure. The actual parks, I think the homes are actually going to stay pretty affordable. I mean, if you're a dealer, you can get, you know, homes 50% cheaper than what you get, you know, paying retail or going to a park, but we sell them at cost. But I think it's here to stay. Yes. I think the stigma is actually going to go away and mobile home parks are going to be cool.
You think it'd be cool?
Yeah.
How long do you think that's going to happen?
Probably about 7-8 years.
When do you think the industry will consolidate where the, you know, only be the top 500 owners owning 90% of them?
I would say about 15 years.
You think it's that far out for consolidation?
Yeah, to where it's only a couple, you know, conglomerates like some Chevron and Shales. Yeah, because a lot of parks are actually low vacancies. They actually have hair on them. When you have these private equity groups, a lot of, you know, they're slower to move because it's a corporation too, and they manage and own from an ivory tower. Actually, I'm in my office here, and Inspire Communities like right down the hall. So I go to them, and they're huge, right?
Yeah.
Go to them, be like, hey, can you actually just let me know whatever you're selling, right? So they're still selling, and you know, but so I don't think that it'll happen for a while. I mean, it's just like apartment building. Well, you can build apartment buildings, but it's just like self-storages. Self-storages are, they're still, you can still buy mom and pops. And I was looking at self-storages in 2006, but I never bought one, but I was looking at them, but they're still out there.
Yeah, storage is consolidated a little further than MH. I've got some storage clients. We've got some money in this LP in storage. We own one storage that came with one of our parks. I'm actually getting ready to sell it. The storage part only. But yeah, I think MH still got some runway to consolidate. I think the bigger parks, the 200 site parks, the 100 site parks, those are going pretty quick.
100%, yeah.
The 50 site parks are a little way to go. And then, yeah, low vacancy. Or low occupancy, high vacancy, those are going to take a while because a lot of these, the REITs, private equity, they don't want to mess with that as much. Or I've seen a lot of them, a couple, you know, one private equity group in particular, they've bought deals with tons of vacancy and then just not done anything. And I'm like, why are you guys owning this? You know, and they haven't sold their parks, but they've bought 100 parks and they've just kind of increased the rent and did nothing else. I'm like, okay, well, this doesn't really feel like a good business plan that they're going to consolidate quickly because they can't be making that much ROI when they're not improving these things.
No, they'll get rid of them. Somebody, you know, somebody will get fired or laid off in that private equity firm. And then somebody will say, we actually need to get rid of these. I mean, that's just how it works. And then, you know, in the business side of things, or they actually could have had some capital and needed to actually put it somewhere. So that, because they needed to actually place capital for their investors.
Yeah, and I've got a guy, he's not really a client. I've done a little bit of work for him in the past, but they bought like 100 parks in like 18 months, and all of them were dogs. I mean, I knew some of these parks. And I'm like, I passed on them, and somebody was asking 800. I offered 500, and these guys paid 850 with the wholesale fee in there. And I'm like, what are you doing? And I talked to them. I met the guy in person at a conference, and I said, what's your strategy? And he said, 100 crappy deals make a big portfolio and somebody will pay a multiple. And he knew he was buying dog deals. And he's like, yeah, but I'm going to get to 100. And then somebody will be like, oh, there's some winners. There's some losers. There's some good markets and bad markets. He's like, and we're going to roll them all up and then we're going to make a ton of money. And maybe they will, I don't think it's happened yet, but I thought it was a really risky approach, and maybe he knows better than me. He was a smart guy with a, you know, big pedigree and everything, but I was just like, how are you going to save these deals? And then we did some of their LLC work, and so I was his registered agent on a couple of things, and I was getting like nasty gram mail from residents, you know, like, your manager is, you know, molesting the, you know, person, the number one's daughter. You should fire him. And I'm like, stop, what? We're just a law firm. We're not, you know, I'm getting the handwritten letters that are like 3 pages of right. all these complaints. It's like, okay, well, I just forwarded them on, like, hey, guys, I'm not saying this is true or not, but it showed up at my doorstep. You guys need to take care of this stuff.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean,
anyway, I see those guys, because I see guys like that that are buying. I'm like, that feels like consolidation, but I'm like, is it going to stick? Or are they just buying stuff and they're going to end up just unloading them one at a time, and then it's going back into the market to people who are actually going to operate them and improve them?
Right. Yeah. Because those operators, you know, or those investors going to say, this one doesn't work. This one doesn't work. I mean, they have to do their due diligence. If they actually even get financing on them, the bank's going to say, we don't like this deal, whatever, for whatever case. And they're going to go back on the market, and then you might have to do seller financing.
Yeah.
Or find a 1031 exchange buyer. So it'll all even out. Yes.
Yeah. Good opinion. Well, Walter, what else? Any other topics you want to cover, or any other tips? And if not, too, where can people find you? And I want to make it, make sure.
I would say a tip, if people actually have park owned homes, what I do that actually helped out with cash flow and with a little bit of value as well, is that I do move-in fee instead of actual deposits. So here in Arizona, if you actually have a deposit, you have to have a separate bank account, you have to collect interest and all that great stuff, right? But if you just have a movement fee, which is half of the deposit, security deposit, you don't actually have to give it back. If they actually trash it, then you keep the money, but you don't have to deal with the separate bank accounts and whatnot. So, and, you know, even if you make, you know, it's $500 move-in fee, I mean, that helps your bottom line.
Interesting. Yeah, one thing we do in some, we do security deposits, but in Kansas, you can only do 1x deposit, but in all our other states, we can do 2x security deposit. So okay. It makes it harder to people to come up the money, but it certainly helps when they move out or break their lease or fall behind. I had one happen today. I was in a meeting, and the guy used to work for us, and it's like, yeah, he's bailed, he moved out, but it's like, yeah, well, we had $1,150 times two, $2,300. You know, that's a nice security deposit. He broke the lease, left a bunch of crap. Like, we're flushing all that. So that's going to move the needle.
Yeah.
He didn't pay, by the time he got him evicted, didn't pay 3 months rent. So, you know, it's not like we made true profit on it, but at least we are going to get back basically 2 months rent through the bigger security deposit.
Yeah. Just imagine if you didn't do that. So, or even if you do that and you can actually advertise zero deposit, and that actually gets people, get some traction as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that definitely gets a lot of action.
Right.
I mean, and we have people all the time, hey, can you work with us on the deposit? And we're always like, no. You know, in your case, you'd be like, yeah, in fact, we don't have any security deposit, just right, a $500, exactly. $500 move-in fee.
They're like, sweet. So, yeah, that works.
Yeah, it's all straight profit.
Yeah.
We do that with pet fees on a lot of deals. You know, we allow pets, and then most states you can have a non-refundable pet fee right out of the gate.
You charge a monthly?
Yeah, we charge pet rent also.
Perfect.
You can't charge pet rent on a service animal or an ESA, but on regular pets, you can do it.
Yeah.
And people pay all the time. We had one guy hit a bunny rabbit. We didn't even know he did. He goes, hey, I got a bunny rabbit. It was called Bonnie the Bunny. And every month he sent, this is back when we collected paper checks. And this is on a duplex we owned, actually. But his name was Cornelius, I think. He sent in a check every month, and it was an extra $25 for pet rent for Bonnie the Bunny. And he wrote a handwritten letter that Bonnie appreciates you letting her stay. And then he was there for like 9 years. And then paid for this pet bunny. And then one time he sent in a letter that said, there will be no pet rent this month. We're sorry that Bonnie passed. Like,
no, face. Really? No.
Yeah, way. I'm like, I didn't know we had a rabbit in there still. So, but he was an honest guy paying the pet rent for years for this bunny.
That is cool.
And it was like, I'm like, I felt bad about it. I think we gave him like gift cards and stuff back because he's a nice guy. But like, hey, here's a Walmart gift card. Everything, like, his bunny is not damaging the house like a large dog, right? But he was, but it was like, well, fair is fair. You have a pet.
So that's true. Exactly.
It wasn't like it was fish.
Not like a German Shepherd, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. So.
All right, Walter. Well, where can people find you after this episode?
Yeah. So Walter at Sonos Capital, SONOSCapital.com, or our website, SonosCapital.com, or give me a call at my office, 480-674-2035.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Mobile Home Park Lawyer Podcast with Ferd Nieman. Ready to learn more? Go to www.themobilehomelawyer.com for free resources and materials to help you succeed. If you love the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts, give us your review, and subscribe today. Thank you for listening. Neither the Supreme Court of Missouri nor the Missouri Bar reviews nor approves certifying organizations or specialist designations. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.